Hello, SLC.
Hello.
It's beautiful to see you. And when I look out, I just see all different colors above your heads. And it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. The title of my talk today is Joy. You know, when I was 12, 13, 14, and in the Baptist church, they had a song that we'd usually sing about joy. And I was in the midst of a miserable cycle of abuse, so I could never sing the words. So I just mouthed them with no sound. But I can sing them today, and I hope you will too. And I'd like to invite us all to just sing the first verse. And it's, I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart.
Where?
Down in my heart.
Where?
Down in my heart. I've got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. Down in my heart to stay. It is so wonderful to be able to sing that song and embody it. Before I forget, I want to tell you that I came here yesterday and I taped an envelope under your chair that will tell you how to find joy. So if you'll get that. Is it not there? Well, maybe I put it on the back of the chair. Actually, I didn't put anything there. But I wanted to illustrate how some people look for joy. They join a new group, and they think, well, this will bring me joy. And it does for a little bit, and then it fades out. And they think, there isn't any joy in this. So maybe they buy a new car. And they love this new smell of the leather and the wind whipping through their hair. But, you know, after a couple months, it just becomes a car, and the joy is no longer there. And I want you to find in deep, enduring, baseline joy like I feel. But first, let's figure out what joy is. In my world, joy is not synonymous with happiness. Happiness can be a part of joy, but it's not the whole of it. Happiness is a fleeting thing, like joining the new group or getting a new car, but it doesn't last for the long term. Joy is an underlying and enduring sense that's deeper than the emotion of happiness. It's more complex. Joy is something that can be practiced, cultivated, and made a habit, and that's what I did. Joy is also a virtue, and it's full of ethical principles. It includes our thoughts, feelings, and actions in all areas of our life that matters. It's an enduring, deep delight. There have been very few studies on joy. However, 20 years ago or so, they did do a study of who are the happiest people on the planet. And they went around, and I don't know how many people on the planet they talked to, but the winner was a tribe in Africa that lived in huts. They were the happiest folks. Why? Because they didn't have to worry about what their money was doing in CDs and in the bank and if it was earning enough interest. They didn't lock their doors, their huts at night. They probably didn't have doors, but they didn't because they had very little to steal, and everything they had, they shared anyway. They hunted, and they foraged for foods, and they got it daily, and they made their clothes. All their needs were met, and they were happy. According to Today, and according to Forbes and others, Finland is the happiest place on Earth, and they have been for the last 7 years. Now, why? Why is Finland, up in that cold, cold part of the world, the happiest place on Earth? One, they have high levels of institutional and personal trust. I don't think we have that here. Their welfare seems to be taken care of, and they have generous unemployment benefits and almost free health care, so everyone feels healthy and safe. It's closely related to social sustainability and feelings of connectedness to the community. The U.S. was ranked 15th, and last on the list was Lithuania. As I've said, there are virtually no studies on joy, no research, and no clear theories about what causes it. Generally, folks think it's connected to goodness, objects, or relationships. So what qualifies as a type of good that produces life-altering, enduring joy? To understand joy, I ask myself, what matters most in our lives? And I answered myself because I'm very polite. And I said, growing in authenticity and living our strengths. 2, growing in depth of relationships and contributing to others. 3, living in alignment with our spiritual and ethical ideas. The more we can do this, live a strength-based life, and have reciprocal relationships and live with ethical coherency, the more joy we experience. Our joy, therefore, is deeply connected to others. It's not just a singular thing. We experience joy and discover it in doing things we love, growing in intimacy, sharing and others while clarifying and coherently pursuing our values. Overlapping ourselves, others, and our values is a gateway to joy. Cahill Gibran said, "Your joy is your sorrow unmasked." And indeed, joy and sorrow are deeply connected. Both joy and sorrow are responses to things that matter to us. When we encounter wonderful experiences, celebrate, and anticipate the unfolding of the wonderful things that are to come, we tap into joy. Conversely, sorrow is our response to deterioration, destruction, and violation of sacred things. Like many of us responded to the deaths due to COVID-19 and the devaluing of human life and structural racism, it leaves us with a deep sorrow. Yet it also shows the complexity of how we can experience joy and sorrow at the same time. How real joy is tethered to our potential to grow as individuals, and it's related into how we treat others and our ethical selves. The key to staying connected to those things that matter in the face of loss and adversity will also lead us to joy. So how do we apply all of this to our lives? Studies show that spiritualism and religion can be really, really an effective resource for meaningful and thriving living. When our sense of purpose, motivations, value, and identity are based on compassion and love, we will act with other-oriented goals. All human beings want to belong to something beyond themselves. In the absence of good religious and spiritual opportunities for these deep significances, they look elsewhere, like civic organizations, causes, and/or political parties. These will give them a sense of motivation, direction, and of belonging. But sadly, not all of these connect, ground, and point them towards pro-social ends that contribute to everyone, not just them. All our paths of attaining enduring baseline joy, they'll be different for you than they were for me. But if you keep working on it, you'll get there. And for me, it was very multifaceted. I came from an extremely abusive background, for which I'm so grateful today and wouldn't change a thing. But during and afterwards, for about 20 years, I engaged in unhealthy ways to keep myself safe. I expected the worst to happen. I was negative, a naysayer. At the time, I thought envisioning the worst-case scenario would protect me when it happened, and therefore it wouldn't hurt so much. But it did the opposite. It drew those negative outcomes to me. Thus, I fulfilled my own prophecy, proved myself right, and became more encouraged to protect myself in that destructive cycle until therapy. In therapy, I realized, with the help of the therapist, not just my own brain, I realized that all the pre-negativity did not diminish the hurt that I felt. It didn't insulate me at all. I still felt the raw edge of betrayal and pain. When I called my father to tell him I was getting married in 2 weeks and would he come, he said he was busy and he couldn't make it. And then he started to hang up and I went, wait, 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 don't you want to know who I'm marrying? And he went, oh yeah, who are you marrying? And I said, well, you met him last year when I came to get a paper signed. And he said, okay, well, great, good luck. And he hung up. I had thought that he wouldn't care. I had envisioned that he wouldn't come. But when it happened, I was just as hurt as I'd been if I hadn't thought those thoughts. It gutted me. All I'd done was stifle my own happiness in the meantime, up until that point. My negativity had deprived me of joy for the time leading up to it. So I changed that. It's work, and it's a lifelong practice. I started back then that when I recognized a negative thought, I'd stop and say aloud, I canceled that thought, and then I'd replace it with a neutral or positive one, like, for instance, talking to my father. Instead of, he won't care or come, I'd replace it with, I don't know the future, and I'm leaving that response open. As I did this, my days became lighter and happier, and I wasn't wallowing in negativity. Next big step for me, in the early 1980s, I ran across a psychologist called Albert Ellis. He's the father of rational emotive behavior therapy. He works on helping folks understand their own self-defeating beliefs and behaviors. At the time, I had bouts of depression. Ellis more or less said that the jolly green giant wasn't standing outside of me, pushing depression into my head. And I thought, wow, that's true. It comes from me. And I ID'd two areas that contributed to these depressive bouts. One was the way I talked to myself in my head, continuing the abuse I'd heard growing up. You're stupid. Became, God, I'm so stupid. How could I be so dumb? Why am I so defective? And I did this over and over and over. Again, it was hard work, but I changed that. When I heard one of these negative self-thoughts cross my mind, and I had to train myself to listen for them, I'd cancel it and replace it. I'm so stupid became, I made a mistake, and I'll correct it. Or, I mishandled that, and I learned from it. It took a couple of years of vigilance until I no longer beat myself up, and it changed my entire being. The second area that contributed to my depressive bouts was not calling a thing and avoiding conflict. When people didn't have time for me or made a snide remark, I'd tell myself they were busy and that they didn't mean it, that they were just upset from something else. If my husband was grumpy, I wondered how I'd made him upset. I remember the first time that I vocalized this. The kids and I were playing a board game while he was watching a game on TV. As the kids and I laughed and bantered playing the game, he'd slightly shake his head and flare his nostrils. Let me tell you, flared nostrils were a big sign for me that I had done something that upset him. And then I would scurry about trying to figure out what it was and how I could make it better. And can I get you this? And It was crazy. But this time, I looked at him and I said, "Are you in a bad mood?" Yes. And he said, "Yes, and I can't hear the game with your guys' loud wooing." And I said, "Okay, well, why don't you take your bad mood in the bedroom where you can watch the TV there and watch the game and thereby not visit it on us?" And he kind of looked like, whoa. But he got up and he went to the bedroom. And afterwards, he came out and he apologized for his behavior. It was a win-win. By the way, studies show that brain chemistry of depressed persons are different than in a non-depressive person. True. But they found that long-term and low-grade depression caused the brain chemistry to change, not that the brain chemistry caused the depression. In my world, if one depressed person can change their brain chemistry, then it can also be changed back to healthy and happy. It would be work. Oh, yeah, it would be work, but it would be so worth it. Some folks who do not like conflict have told me that they think I enjoy it. I don't. But I no longer avoid it. I will honor myself and my feelings and bring whatever it is to the forefront where it can be addressed and thereby resolved. Let's face it, nobody, or hardly anybody, like conflict. But if we all go around avoiding it, nothing gets better. When you avoid the slightest disagreement, you're compromising your true feelings and storing up frustration, which can impact your health. And in my world, I had bouts of depression. You miss opportunities for growth by this avoidance. Growth always means change, and even positive changes can come from discomfort. To avoid conflict is choosing personal stagnation, the opposite of growth. Being conflict avoidant impacts relationships because you're cutting off honest communication with the other person, and in the long run, it hurts intimacy. Lastly, how many of you know that your Creator loves you? Raise your hands. Okay, good. Now, do you know it within the entirety of yourself? Or do you know it intellectually? Until 30 years ago, I often said it, and when someone else said it, I agreed. Every night in bed, I'd tell the Creator how much I appreciated that love, and I'd think of all the ways the Creator had loved me that day. After decades of doing this, one night I said, "You know, I'm going to quit talking and just lay here feel how much you loved me." An incomprehensible warmth swept over me. I felt all 80 billion of the cells in my body stand up and do a happy dance. Each one of those cells had been individually crafted and formed by the Creator to be just me. I was a designer model. And so are you. I no longer just knew that he loved me. I deeply felt that love. It was in me. And ever since that experience, I have lived in a joyous base. I am loved, so loved. Do I get upset ever? Some people ask me. Sure. 6 months ago, I had a conflict with my daughter that made me sad. But where it would have continued to make me sad decades ago, now I knew that the sadness would not stay, that the joy would bubble back up. But the sadness was also okay, and I could feel it because I knew the joy would come back, because joy is my baseline. And because I'm so loved, I can give from what runneth over my cup. By being and absolutely loving everyone, the good, the bad, the ugly, I love them right now where they're planted. I love the thief, the murderer, the rapist right now. I just love everyone That doesn't mean I'll invite them to dinner or let them have a room in my house, but I love them. And love is the only thing that can change them, as it changed me. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you.